All right, let's dive into this Reese v. Barr case that you sent over.
Yeah, this one's a.
It's a fascinating one for sure.
It is. And it's really interesting because it kind of cuts to the heart of what federal courts can and can't do when reviewing state convictions, right?
Right.
So it's not about retrying the case. It's about, did this person get a fair trial?
Yeah, and that's an interesting distinction that I think we're gonna kind of unpack throughout this episode.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So we have a lot of material here. You know, you sent me kind of a hypothetical podcast outline, a detailed case brief, a standard case brief, and even a perplexity analysis,
That's right.
kind of looking at how easily can a machine understand what's going on in this case?
Yeah, exactly. And using those different documents really allows us to dive in from multiple angles, right? We see
Right.
the legal strategy, we see the procedural history, and we even get a sense of how someone might try to simplify this very complex issue.
Right. And so our mission today is to take all of this and give everyone listening a very clear understanding of Reese v. Barr and why it matters,
Yeah.
especially if you're the kind of person who wants to understand these key legal principles quickly, but also thoroughly
And accurately.
and accurately, yes.
Yeah.
So this case really revolves around a man named Romer Reese, who was convicted of manslaughter for the death of his estranged wife, Dee.
Right.
And the real heart of the prosecution's case was Dee's dying declaration.
Right.
She said, "Homer stabbed me," and Homer was Reese's nickname.
Right. Right out of the gate, we have this direct evidence, seemingly.
Right.
But of course, the defense argued that Dee had actually committed suicide, pointing to her past history of drug use and previous attempts. And so right away, you have this incredible tension, the weight of these last words against this whole backstory that suggests self-harm.
Yeah, and that tension, I think, is something that we're going to keep coming back to.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So let's talk about kind of the core conflict of this case. Reese argued that he was denied a fair trial, and he had two main points for this.
Okay.
One was about the admission of Dee's dying declaration,
Okay.
and the other one was about some of the jury instructions that the judge gave.
Right. So he's not necessarily saying that the state got it wrong, but that something about the way the trial was conducted violated his rights in some way.
Exactly. And the state, of course, had gotten a conviction that was upheld in the state appeals process.
Right.
But the big point here is that the federal court denied Reese's petition for a writ of habeas corpus.
And this denial really gets at the heart of it. You know,
Right.
federal courts aren't there just to kind of double check every state court decision.
Right.
They only step in if they see a clear constitutional violation that made the trial fundamentally unfair.
Yeah, it's a very specific role that the federal courts play here.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, going back to the dying declaration,
Live
because
that.
that seemed to be a big part of Reese's argument. There's a very specific three-part test that our sources lay out for what makes a dying declaration admissible in court.
Right. And this test is kind of fascinating because it tries to balance the fact that hearsay evidence, right? Somebody saying what somebody else said is generally considered unreliable.
Right.
But then you have these really unique circumstances where somebody's facing imminent death and the law recognizes that, okay, in this specific situation, maybe there's less of a reason for them to lie.
Right. So what are the three parts of this test?
So first, the declarant, the person making the statement has to be an extremis,
Okay.
which means they are genuinely near death.
Okay.
And second, they have to have a sense of impending death,
Okay.
meaning they understand that they are likely not going to survive.
Got it.
And then third, they have to be competent,
Okay.
which means that if they were alive, they would be able to testify in court.
Okay, so that means they understand what they're saying.
Exactly. They have to be able to perceive things accurately, remember them accurately, and communicate them accurately.
And I imagine that competency one, that's where things can get really tricky.
Oh, absolutely. That's where a lot of the challenges come in
Right.
because you know it's not enough that the person is dying and knows it.
Right.
You also have to look at, were they delirious? Were they on medication? Was there something that could have affected their ability to give a reliable statement?
So in Dee's case, the court found that all three of these criteria were met.
Right.
We have medical testimony about her stab wounds being fatal, and the circumstances definitely make it seem like she knew she was dying.
I mean, being stabbed multiple times is a pretty clear indication that you're in a life or death situation.
Right.
But, and this is where things get really interesting.
Yes.
Remember, the defense was arguing that D had a history of drug use and suicide attempts,
Right.
but they didn't provide any specific evidence to suggest that she was impaired at the moment she made that statement.
So her past history doesn't necessarily mean she was unreliable at that specific time?
Exactly. It's a crucial distinction.
Okay.
You know, her past is relevant. But to successfully challenge the dying declaration, they had to show a direct link between her past issues and her mental state right then and there.
So would you say that the fact that she used Reese's nickname Homer
Yes.
makes the declaration even stronger?
Absolutely. It wasn't just he stabbed me or someone stabbed me.
Right.
She specifically named him using a nickname which suggests a level of familiarity and recognition in that moment.
Right.
So that specificity definitely lends more weight to the statement.
Okay, so now let's look at the other side.
Okay.
The defense argued that Dee had committed suicide, and they pointed to her past drug use and her previous suicide attempts to support that theory.
Right, and this is where it gets really compelling for the jury, right?
Okay.
On the one hand, you have this seemingly very powerful piece of direct evidence in the dying declaration pointing the finger at Reese.
Right.
But then you have this alternative explanation that suggests maybe Dee was responsible for her own death.
Right, and it becomes a question of which story is more believable.
Exactly, and that's the jury's job, to weigh the evidence and decide what makes the most sense.
Okay, so now let's move on to the jury instructions.
Okay.
This was the second part of Reese's argument about being denied a fair trial.
Yes.
So the judge had instructed the jury that prosecutors have to take witnesses as they find them.
Okay.
And this was because some of the prosecution's witnesses had criminal records.
Right.
But Reese argued that by saying this, the judge was implying that he was guilty too.
So the argument is that by kind of highlighting the flaws of their own witnesses,
Right.
the prosecution was subtly hinting that, okay, well, the defendant probably has a shady past too.
Right.
But, you know, it's pretty common for witnesses to have less than perfect backgrounds,
Right.
and both sides have to deal with that.
And the court seemed to agree with that.
They did, yeah.
They saw this instruction as just a neutral reminder that all witnesses have to be evaluated for their credibility.
Right.
It wasn't about Reese, it was about being realistic about who might have relevant information.
And reminding the jury that a witness's past doesn't automatically make them unreliable.
Right.
It's just one factor to consider.
And the defense also objected to the knife being referred to as the murder weapon during the trial.
Right, because they felt like that term was prejudicial.
Right.
It implied that a murder had happened, even though Reese was only convicted of manslaughter.
Right.
So they're concerned about the jury being swayed by language that suggests a higher level of guilt than what was actually proven.
And this again goes back to that very specific role that federal courts have.
Absolutely.
They're not looking for small disagreements with the state court.
Right.
It has to be a fundamental constitutional violation.
Exactly.
So the court's reasoning here was that the term murder weapon was just used descriptively.
Okay.
It was part of a larger set of instructions.
Right.
And those instructions emphasized that Reese was presumed innocent
Yes.
and that the prosecution had to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
And so the court felt like that broader context negated any potential prejudice from that one specific phrase.
Right. They weren't convinced that it would have swayed the jury.
Right.
Okay. So we've talked about habeas corpus a little bit, but I think it's worth kind of explaining that a little bit more.
Sure, yeah.
It's a very specific legal tool.
It is.
It's not just an appeal.
No, it's not a do-over.
Why?
It's really about whether there was fundamental constitutional violation that made the trial unfair.
And even if the federal court found that something went wrong in the state trial,
Yes.
there's also this thing called the harmless error doctrine.
Right.
So even if the dying declaration was admitted improperly, the conviction could still stand if there's enough other evidence to prove Reese's guilt.
Exactly. The error wouldn't have changed the outcome.
And this really brings us to the whole issue of circumstantial evidence,
Right.
because the court very clearly stated that circumstantial evidence is of no less value than direct evidence.
And that's an important point because people often think that eyewitness testimony is always the best.
Right.
But a lot of cases are built on circumstantial evidence,
Right.
where each piece might not be conclusive on its own,
Right.
but together they tell a convincing story.
And in Reese's case, they pointed to a few key pieces of circumstantial evidence.
Yes.
His presence near the scene of the crime,
Okay.
his flight afterwards,
Okay.
and then evidence suggesting that he was unhappy with Dee's refusal to reconcile with her.
Right. So all those pieces together, even though nobody saw him stab her, they paint a picture that supports the prosecution's theory.
And all of this really highlights how much power states have to set their own rules for evidence and procedure.
Right. This is a cornerstone of federalism.
Right.
States are in charge of their own courts, and federal courts only step in when there's a clear constitutional issue.
And there's a quote from our material here that I think really captures this idea.
Okay.
Each state may adopt its own evidentiary rules unless they offend fundamental fairness.
It's that fundamental fairness standard that acts as the dividing line between what states can do and what the federal constitution requires.
So before we wrap up, I think it would be helpful to go over some key takeaways from this case.
Sure.
One is that quote that we just mentioned about circumstantial evidence being just as valuable as direct evidence.
Right, because that really changes how you think about building a case.
Right.
It's not always about that smoking gun.
And another important takeaway is the idea that states have a lot of autonomy in how they run their courts.
Right. They have their own rules and procedures.
Right.
And federal courts generally respect those differences unless there's a clear violation of fundamental fairness.
Right. And there's a quote from our material that I think really sums this up.
Okay.
Each state is free to adopt its own procedures and rules of evidence, and these may not be interfered with by the federal courts unless they offend fundamental principles of justice and fair play.
And I think the most important takeaway, especially for those of you interested in law, is to understand that federal habeas corpus is not just a second bite at the apple.
Right.
It's a very specific legal tool that focuses on whether a state trial was fundamentally unfair from a constitutional perspective.
So you're not just arguing about whether the state court made the right call.
Right.
You have to show that your constitutional rights were violated.
Exactly.
So as we kind of wrap up here, I want to leave you with a question.
Okay.
In a case like this where you have a dying declaration and a lot of circumstantial evidence, what are the most important things to consider to make sure that the defendant gets a fair trial?
And how does that federal habeas corpus process act as a safeguard to make sure that those constitutional rights are being protected?
It's definitely something to think about as you continue to learn about the law.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure.
And we'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.